The Curbsiders Teach podcast is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only, and the topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any diseases or conditions.
Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the speakers and should not be interpreted to reflect the official policy or position of any entity. You should always do your homework and give us any feedback.
Welcome back to the Curbsiders Teach Season 4, our series for clinician educators. I'm Dr. Molly Hoyblind, joined by my co-host, Dr. Ira Krishnaskaya.
Hi.
Yay, we're here today in person. Woo. It's so amazing to be sitting down at the Alliance for Academic Internal Medicine conference this week. And we're so happy to sit down with an Alliance leader, Dr. Lisa Willett, to talk about leadership with a focus on excellence without ego. Before we get started with that, Ira, will you remind the audience what we do on this show?
You got it, Molly. We are the podcast for all things health professions education. We use expert interviews to bring you teaching pearls and practice-changing knowledge to inspire the next generation of clinician educators. And we have a fantastic conversation with our guest, Dr. Willett, tonight. We cover leadership approaches that really center values, you know, taking the best care of patients, humility, and really figuring out what it means to kind of lead a leadership life focused on excellence without ego.
Dr. Lisa Willett is a professor of medicine at the University of Alabama in Birmingham. She is currently working as a hospitalist, and previously her clinical focus was in primary care and hospital medicine for many years. She is currently the vice chair of education and faculty development in the Department of Medicine at UAB. She was the past program director of the Tinsley Harrison Internal Medicine Program. She also was the past president of APTM, and her current focus is around faculty development.
And we're excited to bring you this season of Curbsiders Teach with the support of and in partnership with the Alliance of Academic Internal Medicine. A reminder that most episodes are available for CME credit through VCU Health CE for all healthcare professionals at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. Thank you to all of our Patreon members. And if you love the Curbsiders family content and you haven't joined yet, please consider supporting us and continuing to produce and create this amazing resource.
So without further ado, let's get to it. Yay. Dr. Willett, thank you so much for sitting down and talking with us today. Are you okay if we call you Lisa for this recording?
Yes, please.
Amazing. Thank you. Well, it's so fun to be here in person at the Alliance for Academic Internal Medicine Week Conference. Can you share kind of anything that's been most enjoyable for you about the conference this year, or something that surprised you, something that you're excited to take home with you?
So thank you very much for having me, first of all. And this meeting is amazing. It's my favorite meeting and has been my entire academic career. The best part of this meeting is coming and connecting with people who are truly friends after so many years of their love of medical education. And so the best part of the meeting is just seeing my people who love medical education. One of the cool sessions I went to, though, was the plenary on artificial intelligence by Adam Rodman, and it was, I think, entitled Large Language Models, but it was really fascinating and thought-provoking and terrifying and just really interesting.
Yes. We had the pleasure of sitting down with him and a few other speakers who had also given sessions this week around AI, and super interesting, and I'm not sure the order of how things will come out for these episodes, but so much to learn and really exciting to think about where that's going to go. And we are definitely noobs in this. So.
Yes, very much. A lot of mixed emotions too. Like, oh my gosh, exciting, but scary. And Lisa, just to kind of get to know you a little bit better, if it's okay, would you be able to share a one-liner to describe yourself?
I can. So I would say my one-liner is I'm a middle-aged or mature woman who's a general internist who loves medical education and mentoring. And I'm a wife to a wonderful husband who's very supportive, and have two amazing adult children who inspire me every day to be a better person.
Lisa, what is a book, movie, show, or album that you've recently enjoyed and that you want to share with our listeners?
Okay, so the book that I am currently reading is called This Is Going to Hurt by Adam Kay. And I don't know if you all have heard of it. It is the secret diaries of a junior doctor who's an OBGYN, or was an OBGYN in the NHS in the United Kingdom. It is a really sarcastic book about his medical training as an intern, as a house officer. And I guess it's got some dark humor. It's got a lot of profanity and some perhaps things that might be disturbing. But I will say he balances that with this incredible humanism and what it means to be a doctor and the privilege of that. And it's so funny and so real that I think you can really relate to it. So if you're bothered by profanity, probably don't read it. The other book that I've recently loved that has no profanity at all, I don't believe. And so in stark contrast is called Remarkably Bright Creatures by Shelby Van Pelt. And it is a really just sweet story about a friendship between an octopus that's trapped in an aquarium, maybe not so trapped, but I won't spoil it, and a widow who does the night shift cleaning. And it's just also has a lot of sarcasm, which I guess I really enjoy because both books have that. And it's just really beautifully written. So it's those are my two books that I would recommend for depending on your level of interest.
And profanity tolerance.
And profanity tolerance.
Love it.
Awesome. I haven't heard of either, though. Yeah. So we'll definitely have to check them out.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool. Do you have a favorite failure and maybe one specifically around leadership? But if you have a different favorite one, that's okay, that you feel comfortable sharing with us and kind of what you learned from that?
So many failures. I don't know if I have one around leadership. The one that is still the joke in my family is when I am not very technologically sophisticated, nor am I patient at all with technology. And so I could not get the printer at home to connect. And I was determined that I could figure it out on my own without calling a consult of my husband, and ended up somehow dismantling the entire apparatus and broke the whole, I don't even know what it's called, but, and it took him at least 4 hours to fix the whole thing. And so I was shamed by my family for not stopping to ask for help. And anyway, what I learned from that is if you're not the content expert, one should get a content expert and not always think you can figure it out when you can't. And then also the value of an apology and multiple apologies and moving past it.
Very applicable lessons beyond the printing phase. That shows that you were dedicated to trying to make it work.
I was going to say, that's very impressive to try and dismantle a printer. I think
there are
parts of it that I don't want to even begin to touch or know what to do with. Well, maybe we should move on to our kind of more leadership-focused questions, Lisa, if that works for you. I know you have had such an amazing career, but maybe you could take us back and share really where you see your leadership journey as having started, and then maybe kind of how you've changed, how things have evolved for you as a leader over the time of your career.
Yeah, I think for me, my leadership journey started with becoming the residency program director. And I had the experience from 10 years prior being the associate program director with an incredible mentor. And so I had sort of a close eye view or the ability to watch and observe a great mentor and a great leader. But then really when you step into those shoes yourself, you very quickly have to develop your own leadership style. And there's, watching versus doing are two very different things. So being a residency director for 10 years, I think really shaped my leadership in that there's so many hard things that happen to trainees that involve multiple stakeholders, faculty, patients, academic, medical centers, all of it. And so when you're ultimately the leader responsible for a lot of really important things, it sort of forces you to become, hopefully, a really aspirational leader in that somebody has to speak up. Somebody has to be the one to say what's right, to lead with passion and integrity, and to stand up for what's right and protect the people you have the privilege to serve, and that's patients as well as your learners. And so I think there were multiple events along my 10-year journey of being a program director that really shaped me into a leader. Throughout that, then also through this organization, through AIM, we're here at AIM Week, I was able to become chair of the Scholarship and Survey Committee, which was a really big committee and incredible people. And then that also gave me the podium to share the results of the survey. And that was also an opportunity for leadership. And then without really even realizing it, then I became known for being a program director and then was elected to council and became president of APTIM and other things. And so along the way, these leadership opportunities happened, but probably all just built on top of each other.
Yeah. And I think that's common in many people's careers, that things do build into other things that you don't envision from the beginning. So it sounds like you didn't necessarily have an identity as a leader before growing into those roles, or did you see yourself when you were young as a leader?
I don't know that I really thought of myself as a leader. In hindsight, I think I was told that by other people along the way, but it never really was something that I necessarily was intentional about or saw when I looked in the mirror, I guess. But I think in hindsight, people would say that about me. And I was like, really? Why do you say that? But
Elisa, I think you alluded to this, but could you talk about some of those kind of more, we'll call them like disruptive events in your career that I think made you maybe solidify a leadership approach or kind of change the way that you approach leadership? I think if I remember correctly, in one of the other interviews you gave, there was a safety net hospital closure that you had to deal with. And just wondering whether it was that or something else that you feel it was like, whoa, this is a pivotal moment. Like I can feel myself changing in my approaches.
Yeah. So the very first year I was program director in Birmingham, we have a county hospital, which was where our underserved patients would get care from our residents. And I trained at that institution, trained at UAB, and it was part of my residency training. And it's just really a very special place to care for patients. And my very first year as program director, because of bankruptcy, they actually were going to close the inpatient service at the county hospital. And so there was a lot of challenges of what happened to the hospital when this news was released, when nurses quit, when the resources that were already not where we would have liked them to be became less and less and less. And so it was a huge challenge and one that I was not comfortable navigating at the time because of the politics involved and the levels of all the people being affected from again, the politics of the county to the hospital leadership and so many other people. But as the program director and a brand new program director, I learned very quickly that I couldn't sit back and be passive because of really ultimately the residents were having this experience and ultimately the patients were having this experience. And so it taught me very quickly that I couldn't just sit at the table quietly and wait for someone else to solve this problem, but I had to figure out how to solve it within my levels of my circle of control and the scope of my role. And so it was a big welcome to leadership right away. It was within a month of becoming program director. So it was.
Wow. You got thrown right in.
I got thrown right in. And then there were other, every 2 to 3 years, I feel like there was a major event, whether it was the ACGME changed their whole accreditation system called the NAS, and we were the first program in the country to go through this, which in the competency-based education, which was really exciting and really wonderful. But also, again, a leadership opportunity because it wasn't just the core program having this new accreditation review. It was also all of our fellowships. And so it was organizing a lot of stakeholders in a that had to be really efficient and had very high stakes because it was our accreditation. And so it was really great. I mean, it was a wonderful opportunity to organize, lead, reflect, and then celebrate ultimately the job that we did as a team. And there were many other opportunities, some more painful than others, but they were all ultimately good and sort of shape you.
And sounds like you've mentioned kind of being driven by service to your learners and service to your patients, and also this theory of or this approach of having ownership as a leader. Do you feel like there are some other things that kind of keep you centered as a leader or have developed in your approach to leadership?
Well, I think in medicine, it's very easy to have a value-centered approach to what you do, right? Because at least in medicine, we all agree, hopefully, that we're in this to take the absolute best care of patients. And so when you keep that value at the center of why you're making these decisions, it's really about the patients. And then as a medical educator, it's about those that I am trying to develop into the physicians that, again, will be independently providing that outstanding care. And so I think in some ways, I don't know, as opposed to a banker or a engineer, or I guess, you know, there are teachers and others who have that same sort of value of a greater good, military people. You know, I mean, it's not just physicians, and certainly there's many others in healthcare that also share that value of putting our patients first. But that's, to me, what I guess drives most decisions and makes some decisions somewhat easy when you just remember why you're making these decisions.
I'm also hearing, Lisa, that there's like this component of like you speak up when you see something is wrong. And I think that like some leaders like maybe lead in a less speaking way or maybe in a quieter way. And I wonder how you developed like this, maybe we'll call it like intolerance for like inhumanity or inhumane things. Like how did speaking up really become a bigger part of you as a leader? Because I'm hearing that kind of theme.
I think it's really hard, and it was not something that was comfortable for me, I will say, because it takes courage to be the voice to speak up. And I guess, you know, there was years ago when I became the vice chair for education, and there was a big sort of, you know, state of the school presentation by the dean, or, you know, one of those kind of annual reviews. And I had very recently become the vice chair for education in the department. I can remember, you know, this wonderful presentation talking about all the great research that was happening, all the great clinical care that was happening. And throughout the entire presentation, there was not a word mentioned about GME, at least. There was talk about the medical school. And I can remember sitting in this massive auditorium being bothered by the fact that GME wasn't mentioned. And I can remember looking around the room waiting, sort of, who's here? Who's going to ask that question and speak up and sort of remind everybody that this is also part of one of our core missions? And then it really just hit me in the moment. I thought, oh, well, that's you. Like, so you're the vice chair for education now. That's your job. And so I had to then articulate something that hopefully came off as halfway intelligible and raise my hand and say it loudly and clearly. And it was a moment where I made that conscious decision that I had to speak up because it was my job. And there were many people who came up to me afterwards and said, I'm so glad you spoke up. I was wondering why that was not part of the presentation. And thank you for recognizing this and reminding people that GME matters and all of those things. And so again, I got that instant feedback that, oh yeah, that was the right thing to do. So I've learned from that along the way.
I guess I'm also like, on the other hand, or the flip side, I guess, there's like the speaking up theme, but then there's also kind of your theme of like humility and excellence without ego. And I just wonder that humility aspect, especially, how do you infuse that into your leadership approaches? Like, is it the, you know, I'm going to incorporate this feedback and like sit with this positive feeling that I'm feeling? Or how do you kind of allow that to maybe shine through your approach?
So the excellence without ego came from being program director, interviewing students every year, and our wonderful students would say, how do you describe a UAB resident? How do you, you know, what is important? Who is successful in your program? Those kinds of things. And after hearing that question multiple times in interview season for many years, and I started to really kind of think about it, and I was like, what is so special about the residents in my program? And it came to me that excellence without ego, because that truly, I think, describes beautifully the residents in the program. And because it's not perfection, it's excellence. So sort of the desire to bring your excellence, the best you can be, and do it with humility and without arrogance. And so it's really resonated with me. And I guess maybe what I hope I role model, I've never really had a tolerance for arrogance. And I've had interesting sort of conversations about this with colleagues saying, well, you know, I've had people say, well, you have to have some degree of arrogance to do what I do as an interventional fill in the blank. And so I'll push back and challenge them when they say that. I'm like, there's a difference between confidence and arrogance. So I'm not saying we shouldn't be confident in what we do. We are highly skilled. We are highly trained. We sacrifice long hours. We go through incredible experiences to be really, hopefully, good at what we do. And we should have confidence that we can do it, our job, and we can do it well. But hopefully we don't swing into an arrogance, because I guess the power of medicine is, I mean, medicine is the great humbler. And I think, you know, no matter how long you do it, you will always be surprised by an outcome, or there will be an outcome you did not expect and one you certainly didn't hope for. And so it will humble you whether you want to be or not. So I think it's really important to always think about the other person's perspective, to put yourself in their shoes and to try to have empathy for the people around you. It doesn't mean that you can't lead with confidence, but it is that sort of, you can be excellent and you can also be humble in it. So that, I think that excellence without ego is just those three words that are just really good to remind yourself when you're making hard decisions and you still have to say things strongly and confidently, but you can still have a humility about it.
I think that's really grounding. That's beautiful. And I think good words to live by. For a clinician who's maybe starting to take on more leadership roles or interested in moving into those roles, what kind of tips do you have for building your leadership style or improving your leadership skills?
Yeah, so people should, I think, not be afraid of failure. And I can remember early in my career, I applied for some president of the regional organization or something, and I didn't really want to do it. I was nervous about doing it. I was embarrassed to put my name, you know, all the things, and did not get elected. And then, you know, you're even more embarrassed because you didn't. And one of my mentors, who is also sort of my division director, my boss at the time, who is just such a national expert and so well known, came up to me and he was like, "Oh, I lost that election when I first went for it too, early in my career." And it was just the gift of just sharing that, like, you're going to fail. Like, of course you're not going to get everything you try the first time you try, and you should just try again and keep. So I think my advice to junior faculty and trainees is, you know, just if it seems interesting to you, it seems fun to you, and actually if it seems hard to you, try it, because that's how you get better and that's how you advance, and the next time it won't be as scary and it won't be as hard, and just keep throwing your name in there over and over again, and things will hopefully pan out. There's also value in failing, because then people know your name and they know, oh, well, maybe she didn't get this position, but she's interested in a leadership position, and we read her resume, and so let's think about her for this other opportunity that came up. And so you do get opportunities even from not getting the opportunity you thought you wanted the most.
It's so important to normalize that failure, because it happens to all of us, and we definitely, you know, have this idea of perfectionism in medicine, or a personal drive towards perfectionism. And I think
some of us are recovering perfectionists.
Going towards excellence instead is a great approach. Sounds like your mentor was really helpful in kind of making you more comfortable as a leader. Did you feel like that mentorship continued as you continue to climb as a mentor?
Yeah, I've had multiple mentors along the way, and I will say early in my career, you know, that word wasn't used as much, or maybe if it was, I didn't think it applied to me. And so I can remember in my career thinking, well, I don't really have a mentor, because I didn't go up to someone and say, will you be my mentor? You know, they weren't labeled as such. But in hindsight, I had mentors all around me all the time in all of the many roles that I did. And mentors versus sponsors. So, you know, people who wonder about the difference, a mentor is someone who sort of advises you, a sponsor is someone who puts your name in up for a position and talks about you instead of to you, or, you know, whatever those words are. But I had both. I had tons of people. And then I also, I think, had so much informal peer mentoring and peer support. And again, friendship, sponsorship, mentorship, to me, those words kind of blur one into the other, depending on the person and the situation. And in your career, you should get involved in national organizations, and you should meet people who do what you do at other institutions, and you should get to know them as friends and go to dinner with them. If it's hard for you, if you're shy, I'm sort of not necessarily an outgoing person. People find that hard to believe, but it is true. And so you have to sort of make yourself be uncomfortable and go to the dinners where you don't know anybody, but they were nice enough to invite you. Just go, and you'll make these great friends, and you'll see them the next year. And before you know it, you've got this sort of just network of sponsors, mentors, friends, et cetera, that are there for you when you really need them. And you will be there for them when they need you also.
I almost wonder, Lisa, if there's like a network of leader mentors in your life, or people that you have kind of gone to. Maybe it was the, you know, the person who was like, I failed at that many years ago and many times, you know, but somebody who kind of allowed you to help your leadership skills develop, and other things besides like a network of mentor leaders, will say that it helped your leadership skills grow, or helped you kind of grow as a leader.
I've just been so fortunate to have amazing people in my life, professionally and personally too, but professionally at this organization and others. And so they've been, again, mentors, and they've helped, they've challenged me, but I also kind of watch them, and I watch people who I don't know, who are leading sessions or, you know, hard conversations or meetings at my own institution. And I think throughout my entire career, I've been an observer of specific behaviors and things they do. So there's sort of, there's mentorship directly, but then if you pay attention and you watch people that you respect or people you don't respect, and you see words they use and the way they treat people and when they talk, when they don't talk, just all those things, I think there's, I guess that's not technically mentorship, but you're developing your own leadership style through indirect mentorship or indirect just observing what other people do that you're like, wow, that was really effective how they managed that conflict and what they, the words they said. It's almost like when you were a medical student, I tell my students this is, I did the neurology rotation, the clerkship, and I did not necessarily love neurology. I loved internal medicine. But one of my best residents was my neurology upper-level resident, and the way she presented patients was phenomenal. And I didn't necessarily like the content of neurology as much as medicine, but I could recognize that she was so effective at presenting. And so I tried to pay attention to what words she used and how she presented. And so I think you can gain a lot by observing other people that you respect and admire and then try to incorporate some of that into your own communication style or your own behaviors.
It sounds like you've learned a lot kind of informally through your experiences and through watching other people. Have you taken also a formal leadership course? And is that something that you would recommend to young leaders?
I have, and I would completely recommend it. So when I was about 10 years into my career, I took a master's program in academic medicine. It was a medical education master's program through University of Southern California, Keck School of Medicine. And it was incredible. And it was a three-year program. I thought it was only two. I'm glad I didn't know it was three, because I probably would have said, I can't commit 3 years. So I took that course. It was absolutely incredible. And so I do tell people that absolutely at some point in your career, if there are skills that you want, there are skills you need, you should get those skills. So, I mean, a lot of us have talent and love of teaching and love of being with patients and, you know, all of that. Of course, that's what you love. But you can always get better at it. And there are skills. And so whether you do it early in your career, middle of your career, I don't know that that really matters. It's when it's right for you and your timing of your personal responsibilities and where you are in your own sort of career trajectory. But if there's skills that you need, whether it's research skills or patient safety, whatever it is, I think seek those skills and you deserve to get them. And so it was a really incredible program. I learned a ton. I learned curriculum development. I learned faculty development. I learned how academic medical centers work. I learned all kinds of ACGME competencies, which I already knew because that was my life as a program director, but I was able to apply it to rotations in a different systematic, formal way. And it was just wonderful. There's other conferences on leadership development. There's some specifically for women. AAMC has some. There's lots of programs out there. And I think depending on what your bandwidth is, what your sort of resource level is, who's going to pay for this, who, you know, how are you going to fit it into the rest of your day job and your home life and all those things, just do something. And then also going to academic meetings. There's so much in these workshops and in these interest groups and all of the plenaries, all of the things you can go and you can learn from them. I learned a ton from this organization.
Big shout out to AIM. We love you.
We
appreciate you. Lisa, if we could just go back, I think whether, you know, it was during this master's or kind of when people asked you, how do you describe a UAB resident and it came up, you know, the excellence without ego. How do you feel like that kind of idea shows up for you in your own personal leadership roles, or maybe how you kind of interact with other folks in the health system at UAB or maybe even at AIM or Aptum? Like, how does that really concretely come across for people, if you could name something?
The excellence without ego in leadership.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. That's a good question. I don't.
We're in the business of the good questions over here.
I don't know. Other than, I guess I've been around long enough to realize there's never one way to do anything. As soon as you think this, that you know the right way, there's always five other ways that are just as right. And so I think what I've learned to appreciate in others that I've noticed, and in fact, had this conversation this morning with a very dear friend of mine, one of the things I've learned from her is she is such a good listener, and she listens so carefully and intently to really try to understand sort of what the issues are. And again, I guess that sort of feeds into that excellence without ego, in that if you listen and try to really put yourself where people are coming from, meet them where they are and listen and try to really get a sense of their perspective, their ideas, their solutions, their challenges, I think it's just, it shows that really it's not about you, it's about them. And ultimately, if you're trying to help that person, it is about them. It's not about you. and it's not about how great your advice might be. It's more about where are they and what are they, what are they processing, and how can you help them arrive at the decision that is best for them by just listening.
That was great. I feel like the power of listening is just so underappreciated.
Goes a long way.
Yeah. And I think it's those maybe unappreciated skills that I think makes some leaders great, to be able to say, like, I hear you. And even you kind of amplifying your friend that you met with earlier, and kind of that this is something that really works. And I try to do that too. I think it gives us a lot to think about. That was great.
Can you think of an example of how your unique approach to leadership resulted in an unexpected outcome?
I was invited to be on the survey committee at Aptum, which is a really hard committee with really brilliant people. And I didn't have the skills to be on that survey committee, but I was really interested in learning. And just from sort of showing up, learning, being engaged, following through, which is really important for us to do, follow through on assignments and, right?
Yes. Get it done.
I've been working on this grant. And yes.
If you say you're going to do it, do it. Don't make people chase you down. So it's not that hard, really. But then because of that and how much I loved it and the relationships and the people, then I became chair of the survey committee. And then because the survey gets a national presentation, then I was doing that and getting input from, everybody about the slides. And they were just it was really great presentations because it was a team effort, not because it was me. But the input from the team, and then people got to know me just because I was the person who was sharing those results. And then I was elected to Aptum Council. And then during council, I was became president of Aptum during COVID. And that's when so many changes happened with step one going pass fail and virtual interviews. And, all of those things kind of landed together in 2020. And so I think it was actually the culmination of, I guess, an unexpected outcome that I landed there in 2020 in the middle of the pandemic, of leading conversations and representing an organization that I cared so much about. I don't know that I did it perfectly. I know I didn't do it perfectly, but it wasn't something that I planned, and it was an unexpected outcome of past leadership opportunities that people trusted me with.
Wait, but Lisa, can we just talk about all those things that came together in 2020? I mean, COVID is enough of a thing that happened to all of us. I think we can remember that and the ridiculousness of it. But the fact that it was like confluence of events, like being in this leadership role, having, things go to pass fail, having things change. How did you manage all of that? Or was there like a philosophy that you were kind of using to help you navigate your own leadership role at that time, when such an unstable, uncertain time?
It was really a hard time for everybody, obviously. And there wasn't a lot of time to reflect and gain consensus, just because decisions had to be made so quickly. And you couldn't wait 6 weeks to take a poll. And so you sort of had to do the best you could. And then I think, again, you fall back on, what are the values? What can we all agree upon are the core values of why we're making these decisions? And just make the best decision you can in the moment with the information that you have, trying to do it for the right reasons, and admit this is hard. There's no right answer. We're not going to get consensus. Not everybody's going to agree. And yet we still have to have a decision. We still had to make a decision about virtual interviews versus in person. And I guess that was somewhat easy the first year because it was really just impossible to go in person. But then, as you remember, after vaccines and when we were sort of then in this gray area, then I think the decisions were a little bit harder because without realizing it, you were almost were making decisions for the future. And that wasn't really the intent either. You were sort of wanting to make a short-term decision, but they became long-term decisions. And So it was hard. There was a lot of, and for those of us who overthink things, which is probably all of us in medicine and internists, and perseverate and kind of think of all the potential consequences that you don't want to happen, you can really kind of get yourself stuck in inaction. But that wasn't possible because there had to be a decision. So it was quite a year.
It sounds like you've gotten thrown into these new positions right at the crux of a lot of change.
Trial by fire, what's that saying? Yes, I've had some of that, yeah.
But to your point, Molly, I feel like, Lisa, you got like a master class, or we all got a master class in change management during COVID. And I feel like for you, it was all these decisions that had to be made while managing change for an organization, for UAB, for Aptum, like, or, you know, AIM in general. I think that's a lot of difficulty and a lot of weight on your shoulders. How did you handle that? Like, what worked for you? Was there a support network?
Definitely you lean on your support network. And there were so many people going through similar things that it was really helpful for me to have friends at other institutions who were going through similar things at their institution, but could share the same frustrations, because you need people to validate that you're not crazy. And so they were my lifeline. I mean, you just reached out to your friends and I group text with handfuls of people who were doing the same thing. And it was just, they became really important to you and your team, and chief residents who, again, the stories that we could all tell probably from where we were doing what, but to have a close cabinet of really trusted people is what gets you through those really hard times.
Well, I guess I wonder, as a earlier career person, maybe, what would you share about kind of advice in terms of leadership development? I mean, I've heard so much already, kind of value-based approaches, speaking up, kind of that, understanding that medicine is the great humbler and kind of being able to also harness that humility. Are there other pieces of advice that you would offer, maybe mid-career people, junior people, on really developing their skills as leaders?
I think what I would tell junior people in mid-career is to just try things. It's this double-edged sword, right? You don't want to say yes to everything and then you really have overextended yourself and you're not effective. But then there's also, I think, the other extreme that is also equally a bad decision is to say no to everything. Because you finish residency and fellowship, if you do fellowship, and you experienced a lot of clinical medicine, but you really haven't experienced much outside of clinical medicine. And so things that you don't even know that you would be interested in, you should try. For example, when I was very early in junior faculty, a colleague gave me the opportunity to be involved in the UME medical school, first 2 years of medical students with the clinical skills development curriculum. And it was never something, I always thought I was a GME teacher. It sounded interesting enough to me where I was like, thanks for the opportunity. And I learned so much from, I get my own physical exam skills got better. Because if you're going to teach it, you have to figure out, make sure you're doing it right. So there was so much I learned from the experience. And you don't have to do things forever either. It's okay to try things for 1 or 2 or 3 years. Follow through, do a good job, see if it really is not for you, it's okay to then step out of it. You don't have to stay in something that just doesn't get you excited, but there's still skills and there's still things you can learn from it. And it's also building your resume along the way. And so my advice to when I have junior faculty come and talk to me, I'm like, if it sounds interesting, try it. Give it some time and then step out of it if you don't like it. But don't feel like you have to I have to plan my whole 20 years today, because you don't. And things will change and your interests will change and the people around you will change. And so you should just be willing to try some things.
Yeah, I love that, because I feel like in academic medicine, there's so many different paths you can take with your career. And the podcasting, for example, I just got asked to be a guest many years ago and came on as, the one interviewed. And then it's just really expanded from there. And it's created such a wonderful network of people. And but you never know. I didn't know I would like it stepping into it.
Yeah. And I do think if someone offers you something, don't make a decision on the spot. I mean, say to that person, wow, thank you so much for thinking of me. Could I have a week to think it over, talk to my mentor, and let me get back to you? And because you don't need to say yes right away. You don't need to say no right away. If you really don't know, you should take some time and think about it. And then also, if you really don't want to do it, it's okay to say, thank you for the opportunity. The timing's really not right for me right now, but please consider me for future opportunities. Specifically, I'm really interested in X, Y, and Z and hoping to get some opportunities to grow in that area. And I think if you don't sort of articulate what you're most interested in, people won't know. And so there's no harm in telling people, and then they'll think of you maybe.
I think that's actually like a huge pearl for the mentorship sponsorship conversation that we've kind of mini had in our leadership conversation, which is that if people don't know what you're actually interested in and excited about, they won't know what to kind of put your name in for or to, you know, sponsor you for. So I found myself at least telling a lot of my mentees, like, if you tell me what it is that you're really interested in or kind of excited about, it's so much clearer for your mentors and your sponsors to be able to say, oh, this position came up in, you know, XYZ field, like this sounds like something that would be perfect for you. Or, you know, do you mind if I nominate you for this award because it's about this thing that you really love? And it almost takes the guesswork out of it. It's like giving feedback or having feedback conversations. Like if somebody's like, I'm working on my physical exam, you could be like, great, I'm going to focus on that. I find that's the same for kind of mentorship and opportunities.
I think that's great advice. And I think if there's someone in your institution or your department or whatever that's doing something that you think you want to be doing in your career, and they're a leader in that, go meet with them. Mm-hmm. I find people are incredibly generous with their time, and they're incredibly honest about how they got to this point and mm-hmm. what they did along the way. And so I totally agree with you. Go, you know, set up a meeting and go with your questions and be curious and learn from them. And also then they get to know that you're interested in this too. And they think of you. And they'll reach out to you and perhaps sponsor you. And you just don't know the opportunities that might create for you later. And you'll also probably find that people rarely get from A to B in a straight line.
Yes.
Most people have a little bit of a twisty, turny path and a lot of serendipity and a lot of like, oh, who knew? To your point about, you know, I didn't know I would love this and I do. So.
And if you today, Lisa, could go back and talk to your former self back in the midst of that hospital closure, in the midst of being thrown into that new role, do you have some advice that you would give to your past self?
Yeah, don't lose sleep over it. It's going to be okay. Yeah. And although I guess I still lose sleep over hard decisions, I think the advice is just hang in there. You're sort of stronger than you think. Your voice is louder than you think. And you have the skills to do this. You may not know it yet, but they're there, and you just need to sort of have the confidence to speak up, take one step at a time, get through today, and just keep doing your best, and it eventually sort of pays off, hopefully, and you grow from it. And then I think also too, reflecting on, well, what did I do and what did I say and could I have done that better? And then not beating yourself up about it, just being like, okay, yeah, I really could have done that better. And then you just learn from it and you hopefully do it better next time. You kind of move on.
I want to highlight one thing you said, Lisa, which is I think you have such a beautiful way of like observation and commenting on being aware and then being reflective about what you were aware of. And I think sometimes we go through life just like with so much inertia, like I just need to get through this day and you get through this month. Like, and you don't take a second and say, wow, what happened that made that conversation go really well? Like when you're talking about that person who managed that conflict really well. And I think that that's kind of a mental note for me, at least, is, you know, the focus on actually reflecting on your observations, like noting them in the moment, but then going back and being like, what was that? That was so rich and powerful mm-hmm. in the moment. I really appreciate that approach of yours.
Well, this has been really fantastic. I loved hearing from you and a lot to think about. Do you have any summary of take-home points that you want to leave our listeners with?
I guess take-home points from a leadership standpoint is you are absolutely a leader. You're a leader in what you do, whether it's with your patients, with your learners, with your community, with your institution. You are a leader. And so be proud of that and take that responsibility very seriously, because we need great leaders. And when you're invited to the table, don't shy away. Don't think you're not qualified. Don't think you're not capable. Just sort of try it and then reflect on it, learn from it. But don't be afraid. Don't pass on an opportunity because you're afraid of it. Because you will grow and you will learn. And just from the opportunity, if you observe other people, you'll sort of, you never, that will those lessons will probably come back to help you later in life. And so I guess my take home points are try to be a leader. You are a leader. So lead well, lead with confidence, not arrogance, lead with without ego, have excellence without ego. And then support everyone around you too, because there's so much more fun to our careers when you do it in a team with other people and you get to share your passions and share your love of what you do and pass it on to the next generation.
I love that. We always ask people kind of anything that you want to plug, Lisa, anything that you're working on, excited about, anything like that.
I guess what I would plug is to go to meetings and make connections. And whether that's if they have a sign up for a mentor and that's really uncomfortable for you, do it anyway. So go to meetings, do things that are uncomfortable, and make yourself stretch, because that's how you get better.
Love it. Yeah. Well, thank you so much. This has been really wonderful. And we so appreciate your time and your wisdom. And I think this will be amazing for our listeners.
Thanks so much for inviting me.
Yeah.
That was awesome.
Well, yeah, that was so amazing. I loved listening to Dr. Willett, and I feel like she had so much to share and so much to reflect on. I think two small things for me was, one, kind of her discussion about a more informal mentoring network and not necessarily having just those people that are formally assigned as your mentors, but also just learning from your colleagues and your peers and watching the people around you and reflecting on that, I think is really powerful. And then I loved her recommendation of, if you're saying no to an opportunity, say, thank you so much for the opportunity. This isn't quite the right thing for me right now. Here are the things that I'm interested in if you have things that come up down the line. Because I think, you know, sometimes we worry that saying no means that you won't get asked again for future things. But I really liked kind of that reframing of, here's really what I want to focus on.
Totally, Molly. I super appreciated those points. And I also love that she kind of reminded us the power of listening as a leader. I think there's something, could probably do a whole episode on listening. I think there's like different types of listening.
Stages,
yeah,
of listening.
Exactly.
Layers.
Exactly. Layers, types, stages, all the things, you know. But I just really found that powerful to remember that as a leader, you're one of your, you know, special skills or special powers is actually the ability to listen and to also, you know, project confidence, but not arrogance, that we are, you know, competent in certain things. We are confident in our competence, but just that lack of the layer of arrogance. I think Lisa just brought that home. And I think she lives it too. Like, I can see it in the way that she's speaking and kind of how she describes the ways that she had to be a leader in such chaotic, ridiculous times. So what a great chat.
Well, this has been another episode of our Curbsiders series, The Curbsiders Teach. Get your show notes at thecurbsiders.com/teach. A special thanks to the Alliance for Academic Internal Medicine for making this season possible and welcoming us here to Columbus. And thanks to Dr. Matt Lauto and Dr. Paul Williams for their support in this project. Thanks to the team at PodPaste for editing and production support. Until next time, I've been Dr. Molly Hoytlein.
And we're committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge. And to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts or contact us at thecurbsidersteach@gmail.com. A reminder that this and many episodes are available for CME credit for all healthcare professionals at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. All you have to do is create an account. And I've been Dr. Ira Krasnovskaya. Thank you for joining us today and letting us bring you a little nugget of medical edutainment.